Navin did not exist before this episode. What they're about to describe is happening across London as you listen. This is their story. In Hampstead and Highgate, NHS training places sit empty, while qualified healthcare workers cannot access the programmes that would put them on the wards where they are desperately needed. The gap between what the health service requires and what its funding structures permit has left both patients and potential nurses stranded on opposite sides of an artificial divide.
My parents came to Britain in the 1980s with nothing but hope and determination. They built their corner shop in Kentish Town from scratch, working 18-hour days to give my sister and me opportunities they never had. Growing up behind that counter taught me the value of service, of being there when your community needs you. That's what drew me to healthcare. After university, I worked as a healthcare assistant at the Royal Free Hospital for 3 years. Every shift reinforced my belief that this was where I belonged. The nurses I worked alongside were incredible, but they were stretched thin, handling caseloads that should have been shared among twice as many people. I watched them make impossible decisions about where to spend their limited time, and knowing that somewhere else on the ward someone was waiting longer than they should, I wanted to be part of the solution. The turning point came when my younger sister fell into severe depression. Watching her struggle to access proper mental health support showed me how much the NHS needed people who understood both the clinical side and the human side of care. She eventually got the help she needed, but only after months of fighting through a system that seemed designed to deflect rather than heal. I decided to train as a nurse, specializing in mental health. In 2022, I applied to Health Education England's Nursing Degree Apprenticeship Program. This seemed perfect. I could train while working, earning a salary, and gaining real experience at the Royal Free Hospital, where my managers had already confirmed they had mentorship capacity and welcomed my application. I scored highly on all the assessments. Everything looked set. Then came the letter from Health Education England. My application had been successful, they said, but my place was being deferred indefinitely. The funding had been constrained by Treasury spending limits. They suggested I try again next year, when allocations might be different. I didn't accept this as the end. I applied directly to universities for traditional nursing degrees, but without the NHS bursary that had been cut years earlier, the fees were impossible. My parents' shop was struggling after the pandemic, and I was already helping them with rent and suppliers. Taking on thousands in student debt while giving up my healthcare assistant salary wasn't an option. I contacted NHS England about their fast-track programs. Surely there had to be another route.
The response was the same. Budget allocations have been capped. The person I spoke to sounded genuinely sympathetic, but explained that Treasury had set strict limits on training expenditure for the year. In desperation, I contacted my local MP's office. The caseworker confirmed what I'd been told. Treasury had indeed limited Health Education England's training budget, despite the NHS workforce crisis. "There is no funding," she said, as though this explained everything. "The government simply cannot afford to train more nurses right now." For months, I accepted this. It sounded reasonable. The country was facing economic pressures. Difficult choices had to be made. Everyone was tightening their belts. The language of constraint felt familiar from my parents' business struggles. Then one autumn morning, walking past the old Highgate Education Centre, I noticed something that didn't fit. Through the tall windows, I could see fully equipped simulation wards sitting empty. Hundreds of chairs were arranged in lecture halls where dust gathered on whiteboards. High-tech medical training equipment sat under covers. The security guard, noticing my interest, struck up a conversation. "Used to train 200 nurses a year in there," he told me. "Brilliant facility. Then the funding got pulled in 2020. Been empty ever since, except for the odd private rental." That same week, at a community event in Gospel Oak, I met three qualified nurses from overseas. They were all at the local job centre, struggling with visa costs and recognition delays, while they tried to get their qualifications recognized by the Nursing and Midwifery Council. Each had a years of experience. Each was desperate to work. And down the road, the Royal Free Hospital had dozens of nursing vacancies advertised on their website. The contradiction became impossible to ignore. The government that issues the pound told me it could not find enough pounds to connect qualified, willing people to desperately needed work. The training facility existed. The mentorship capacity existed at the hospital. The people who wanted to train existed. The overseas nurses who wanted to work existed. The patients who needed care existed. What exactly was it that there was no money for? Not the bricks and mortar of the training center. They were sitting empty. Not the equipment. It was gathering dust under covers. Not the teaching staff. Many were now working privately or had left the profession entirely. Not the people who wanted to learn. We were all still here. I started to understand that the phrase, "we cannot afford it," means something different when it comes from a government than when it comes from my parents' shop. My parents genuinely couldn't afford things. They didn't issue the pounds in their till, but the UK government does issue the currency. When Treasury said there was no funding for nurse training, they weren't discovering an empty vault. They were choosing not to create the money that would connect willing people to necessary work. The real question was never about money. It was about whether the people existed, whether the skills could be taught, whether the materials were available. They were, all of them. I'm still here, still working as a healthcare assistant, still watching qualified people unable to access training, while wards run short-staffed, but I see the situation differently now. I used to accept the excuse that there was no money. I hear it differently now. The government that prints the notes and mints the coins told me it could not find enough of them to train the people who were standing right there ready to work. The excuse was not a fact. It was a choice, wrapped in the language of impossibility. It is the same logic as a household that says, "we cannot afford it," except a household does not issue its own currency. The government does. The limit was never the money. The limit was the willingness to spend it into the places and the people who needed it. What happened to me is happening across every constituency where people and needs exist side by side. While someone in Westminster says the cupboard is bare, the resources exist, the people exist. The choice not to connect them is political, not financial.
What Navin experienced has a name: fake experts. This technique works by citing economists or commentators who treat the household budget analogy as self-evident, as though repeating it makes it true. The tobacco industry pioneered this approach. For decades, they funded scientists who questioned the link between smoking and cancer, creating false balance in public debate. The experts had credentials, but their conclusions served the industry that paid them. In Navin's story, every door that closed came with the same refrain. Economists say we cannot spend more on health without causing inflation. Which economists? The profession is divided. Many macroeconomists argue the binding constraint is real capacity, not currency. Economists say, without naming them, is an appeal to unnamed authority. The fake experts maintain that government spending must be rationed like household spending, despite the fundamental difference. Households don't issue their own currency. When Treasury cited spending limits for nurse training, they were applying household logic to a currency issuer. The empty training centre and unemployed qualified nurses proved the opposite. The real resources existed and were sitting idle. The resources existed. The people existed. The decision not to connect them was political, not financial. Hampstead and Highgate ranks 362 out of 543 English constituencies on the deprivation index, placing it in decile 7. English Indices of Deprivation 2025 MHCLG. The constituency has 1,518 registered charities, Charity Commission Register, England and Wales. Total grants received amount to £54.7 million, 360 giving grant nav. All sources are published at blockedbritain.co.uk. Blocked Britain tells the stories of people whose lives are shaped by the gap between what Britain needs and what its institutions choose to provide. Every character is fictional. Every situation is drawn from official statistics, produced by Blocked Britain.